This is Bird Note. For some birds, having the best nest is a key part of attracting a mate. Males of many weaver bird species construct a series of intricately woven nests with which to lure a prospective partner. If a female is dissatisfied with it, though, she doesn't just move on. She tears the nest apart, as if to show her disdain. A male red-winged blackbird can even attract multiple mates if he controls a prime breeding territory, where nests can be built over the water, making them less accessible to predators like raccoons. Adélie penguins construct their nests on mounds of stones, which help guard against flooding, and partners often exchange stone gifts during the course of construction. Unfortunately, stones can be in short supply, which leads to skirmishes within the nesting colony, as stones are stolen and fiercely guarded. No stone, one might say, left unturned. For Bird Note, I'm Wenfei Tong.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
Oligarchies promote huge economic inequality and tend to support authoritarianism. They must be challenged by the resistance for there to be genuine democratic revival. Resistance must stop a rising authoritarian from weaponizing the state. Support for the values of democracy can jumpstart organizing the resistance. Mobilizing civil society can begin to fill the void left by institutions that Trump has captured, including the Congress, the Supreme Court, and the Republican Party.
That's John Shattuck, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features John Shattuck on resistance. In a time when scoundrels abound and corruption is rife, the need for resistance is critical. This is no time for fence-sitting and twiddling thumbs. Throughout history, people have fought and defeated autocracy by organizing with allies to challenge, disrupt, and roll back unfair rule. We are in such a moment now, as power is being centralized and the rule of law and decency are being undermined. The odds may seem too difficult, but perseverance and collective action can be effective. Through resistance, authoritarian rule can be rolled back. Historian Howard Zinn reminds us, the power of tyranny is overestimated and can be overcome by the unity and the determination of apparently powerless people. Our guest today is John Shattuck. He's President Emeritus of the Central European University and Professor of the Practice in Diplomacy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He spoke at Boston University in December. And now, John Shattuck.
It's a great privilege to be here, and above all, a great privilege to be invited and an honor to give the Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture this year. Howard Zinn is an iconic figure for many of us. His monumental People's History of the United States is full of stories of political oppression and resistance. In fact, that's the entire topic. The most famous, of course, is the American Revolution, which I join Howard Zinn in believing has not yet been completed. and is still being fought by the people. He urged the people to keep on resisting. And when we organize with one another, he wrote in A People's History, when we get involved, when we stand up and speak out together, we can create a power that no government can suppress. So I want to pay tribute tonight to Howard Zinn's achievement in getting us to recognize that history, in the end, is written by ordinary people doing extraordinary things. The introduction to the latest edition of A People's History points to the core Zinn belief that, and I quote, change comes from below, from people resisting and organizing, workers going on strike, consumers boycotting, soldiers saying no to illegal orders, and that we cannot rely on leaders, but instead have to rely on our individual and collective actions to support the values of liberty and justice for all. Today's resistors draw inspiration from the civil rights movement with its deep roots here at BU. Martin Luther King studied here and was influenced by the nonviolent resistance philosophy of Howard Thurman and Mahatma Gandhi. It was here that King learned about the moral force of nonviolence that he later put at the center of the great movement of ordinary people doing extraordinary things, like Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, who resisted oppression by refusing to cooperate with the oppressor. So, with that introduction, now let's turn to the situation today. We'll begin with the counter-revolution that's transforming democracy into authoritarianism in the U.S. and Europe. I'll look at how this got started, review the playbook that the new authoritarians are using, then focus on what can be done to build up the resistance. So we're now a year into the second coming of Donald Trump as president. Trump has asserted, to be very simple about it, new presidential powers to weaponize the government against anyone who opposes him, to rule by executive decree, to use the presidency to enrich and aggrandize himself, and to act with total impunity in defiance of the rule of law. Now, authoritarianism, a big word, is defined as the assertion of unlimited authority at the expense of freedom. Most white middle-class Americans today have not experienced this kind of authoritarianism, and many people in positions of power who should know better are eager to appease a rising authoritarian because they think this will protect their interests. So before we go any further, let's look at why appeasement doesn't work. Maria Ressa, the Philippine journalist who won a Nobel Peace Prize in 2022 for her courageous reporting about a brutal dictatorship in the Philippines, explained it this way. Appeasement will only make an authoritarian stronger. The power of citizens to resist a rising dictator will never be greater than it is today. So to keep rising, an authoritarian must keep accumulating power. And a rising dictator can only be restrained when the people act to reduce his power. This is what began to happen in last month's elections in New York, New Jersey, Virginia, California, Maine, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Mississippi, and other places. Howard Zinn often observed that the power of the people on top depends on obedience of the people below. And last month, the people below made clear they wanted to replace the people on top. Now, an authoritarian who seeks to take over a democracy must first undermine a democratic electoral process that might restrain his power. This is what Donald Trump is trying to do by Republican gerrymandering and voter suppression, and the resistance must organize to stop him. Many people don't realize that the basic elements of the strategy that Trump is following today were written 15 years ago in Hungary by Viktor Orban, Trump's favorite authoritarian. Orban took over Hungary in 2010 by winning a democratic election and then transforming a democracy into an authoritarian state. Orbán is really Trump's political guide and the author of the original authoritarian playbook that Trump is following today. In fact, Steve Bannon declares that, quote, Orbán was Trump before Trump was Trump, and tells us to study the rise of Orbán in order to understand the rise of Trump. So let's do that. The story of Orbán's rise begins at the end of the Cold War when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989 and authoritarian communist regimes were swept out of Hungary and the rest of Eastern Europe. What seemed impossible suddenly happened. The forces propelling democracy suddenly seemed unstoppable. East-West political barriers collapsed, elections and market economies sprang up, the Soviet Union dissolved, and a new global economy began to take over. These changes led one optimistic observer at the time to predict the end of history, with democracy as the final form of government. But of course, this was too good to be true. Darker forces were at work, and they were producing very different kinds of changes. With economic globalization taking over, companies began moving factories overseas. Market economies began slashing social spending. Economic inequality grew rapidly between the new oligarchs created by globalization and the rest of the people. Refugees began flooding into Europe from the Middle East and into the U.S. from Central America, and a huge backlash against the disruptive changes turned into reactionary populism and racist politics. New authoritarians began to emerge in Europe just about this time, first in Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, where Slobodan Milosevic fanned the flames of ethnic and religious conflict into the first genocide in Europe since the Second World War. In Russia in the early 2000s, where Vladimir Putin built a corrupt nationalist regime based on a new Russian oligarchy. In Hungary in the 2010s, where Viktor Orbán undermined democratic institutions. And eventually in the U.S. after 2016, where Donald Trump began to emulate Viktor Orbán. I had a front row seat to all this. I was Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the early 1990s, and I witnessed the genocide in Yugoslavia, and I worked to stop the war. And then as Ambassador to the Czech Republic in the late 1990s, I saw the positive side of the decade, the transformation of an authoritarian state into a democracy. Then, as President of Central European University in Budapest in the 2010s, I watched Viktor Orbán turn a new democracy back into an authoritarian state. So what can we learn from this to help us understand what's happening now in the U.S.? In Hungary, people had been left behind by globalization. The financial crisis of 2008 hit them hard, and many began to feel they were actually worse off than they had been under communism. Hungarian politics were deeply divided between a rural population and an urban elite who dominated the country. This set the stage for Orbán. And in 2009, he began attacking the elites and promising, yes, he did it first, to make Hungary great again. He railed against refugees, calling them a threat to Christian civilization. He vowed to protect Hungarians from foreigners and people of other races and religions, and he created a new tribal identity politics that swept him into power. Does this sound familiar? Orbán's playbook for accumulating power was deployed in Hungary 15 years ago, and it became the blueprint for Trump's Project 2025. Here's the playbook. Take over your party and enforce discipline by using threats and intimidation to stamp out dissent. Build your base by appealing to hatred and racism and branding minorities and immigrants as dangers to society and demonizing your opponents as enemies of the people. Use misinformation and lies to justify what you're doing. Use your election to claim unlimited power. Centralize your power by dismantling and replacing the civil service. Redefine the rule of law as the rule by your executive decree. Eliminate checks and balances and separation of powers by taking over the legislature, the courts, the media, and civil society. Create a new oligarchy to fund your party and run the economy, and intimidate and subdue the public into believing all this is necessary and resistance is futile. This was all done by Viktor Orban and is now being copied by Donald Trump. When earlier this year Trump began attacking universities in the U.S., I wasn't surprised. I'd seen this before when I was on the receiving end of attacks by Orban when I was president of CEU. So why do authoritarians attack universities? Because academic freedom threatens their power to control the national narrative. Orban targeted CEU because it threatened his narrative about the Holocaust in Hungary. Orban had made himself popular with his nationalist supporters by declaring that the Holocaust was imposed on Hungarians by the Germans, and he even built a monument at the center of Budapest to commemorate that. But Hungary had been an ally of Germany in World War II, and authoritative academic research showed that Hungarians themselves carried out the Holocaust in Hungary. Orban demanded that CEU revise this research. We refused and drew a red line to protect our academic freedom. Two other targets of Orban's censorship were gender studies and migration studies, subjects later also targeted by Trump at U.S. universities. Again, at CEU, we refused to be censored. We were able to protect our academic freedom because CEU was not funded by the Hungarian government. But other universities were vulnerable, and Orban brought them under his control. Today, Donald Trump is trying to do exactly the same thing to U.S. universities. He's using federal funding of research as a weapon to coerce them to pay penalties for alleged but unproven and unrelated violations of law. And to avoid the cutoff of funds, universities are being pressured to surrender their autonomy to Trump. Under this scheme, Trump has made himself the academic dealmaker in chief, a position he obviously relishes. Regulation by academic dealmaking is a total violation of constitutional, statutory, and administrative law. It deprives a university of its right to due process. It violates the university's First Amendment rights. It circumvents the civil rights laws enacted by the Congress. And it makes new rules for universities in violation of administrative law. Now, Trump's deal-making agreements really are nothing more, therefore, than the products of a big extortion scheme. Columbia was unfortunate to be the first university coerced into this scheme, and other universities later negotiated their own deals. Harvard took a different approach. Bolstered by a healthy endowment, it took what was clearly a risk in challenging Trump's demands in court. It won all aspects of its case at the district court level. The judge ruled that Trump could not restrict Harvard's competitive research funding, quote, in retaliation for the university's exercise of its First Amendment rights or on any purported grounds of discrimination without complying with civil rights law. Trump now has another scheme to control universities, a so-called compact with the government. In August, the administration offered preferential funding to any university that agreed to comply with the Trump agenda. In some ways, the compact scheme is even worse than the deal-making scheme. It's more intrusive on academic freedom. For example, it requires a university to abolish any academic unit that, and I quote, belittles conservative ideas, close quote, and it requires universities to use completely undefined objective standards for admissions, all subject to Justice Department oversight and enforcement. In a show of collective resistance, seven universities have now declined the compact proposal, and two dozen other universities, I'm happy to say including BU, have signed an amicus brief supporting Harvard's lawsuit against Trump. Now, Harvard's case illustrates an important element of the overall resistance, resisting the authoritarian in court. In Trump's first 6 months, 337 cases were filed challenging his authoritarian actions. Federal judges ruled against him in 165 cases, and the administration defied court oversight in 57 cases. Trump has repeatedly attacked the federal courts and has often defied their rulings. While the lower federal courts have restrained some of his authoritarian actions, the Supreme Court has yet to rule against Trump in a major case challenging his authoritarian rule. We shall soon see how that turns out. Before drawing lessons from all this, let's briefly review the record over the past year of Trump's actions that follow the authoritarian playbook first written by Viktor Orban. Weaponizing the federal government to target critics and opponents, defying the Constitution, federal judges, laws, and congressional appropriations, deploying federal troops to cities to intimidate people, using police state tactics to round up immigrants, carrying out mass firings of career civil servants and scientists, coercing law firms and universities to make extortionate payments, challenging the legitimacy of elections and the certification of results, and spreading disinformation and lies to persuade and confuse the public about all of this. So, enough of what's happening. Now let's talk about how to build up the resistance. What lessons should we take into account? The first big lesson is that populist rebellions, like the ones I've been talking about, can shake up democracy. Rebellion starts as a reaction to a major series of disruptive events, like economic collapse or globalization, and it demands response to its grievances. Where does this lead? It can lead to democratic revival, as it did in the U.S. in the 1930s under Roosevelt during the Great Depression, or it can lead to authoritarianism, as it did in Hungary in the 2010s under Orban and now in the U.S. under Trump. Now, populism can be steered toward democratic revival by building left-right coalitions for fairness on demands like affordability, health care, and housing. There are historical examples of this, like the 19th century farmer labor coalition that brought together urban workers, white farmers, and black sharecroppers, and led to the progressive movement and the New Deal in the 20th century. On the other hand, there are bad examples of where populism can lead, demanding new leaders to revitalize the economy who support oligarchies, like the 19th century robber barons and the tech titans of today. Oligarchies promote huge economic inequality and tend to support authoritarianism. They must be challenged by the resistance for there to be genuine democratic revival. So a second lesson is that democracy is a patriotic cause, and the national flag must be reclaimed. In the Orban-Trump playbook, the authoritarian hijacks the flag. And in some earlier resistance movements, for example, against the war in Vietnam, the flag was rejected by resistors as a symbol of the very regime they were challenging. But the flag of democracy is a symbol of the rule of law, of a society built on human rights and freedoms. And flying the flag has been a major feature of this year's No Kings protests across America. It stands for defending democratic values against authoritarian attack. So a third lesson is that resistance must stop a rising authoritarian from weaponizing the state. Opponents are being attacked with criminal penalties like prosecution, regulatory penalties like tax audits, educational penalties like the denial of research funding, political penalties like harassment investigations, physical penalties like the withdrawing of police or Secret Service protection. Any institution that's targeted, for example, a university or a law firm or a media company, should resist and not try to appease the authoritarian. And those that aren't immediately targeted should join the resistance, both to protect themselves and to protect democracy. So last month's elections showed that there's already a high level of political resistance to the Trump-Orban playbook. And underlying the election results are polls that reveal an overwhelming majority of Americans continue supporting the very values that are under attack by the authoritarian. In the face of Trump's decrees, Americans report that their most important values continue to be freedom and fairness. And a poll by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago shows that huge bipartisan majorities endorse as fundamental the right to vote, to equal opportunity, to freedom of speech, to racial equality, and to the protection of personal data. Support for the values of democracy can jumpstart organizing the resistance. Mobilizing civil society can begin to fill the void left by institutions that Trump has captured, including the Congress, the Supreme Court, and the Republican Party. The challenge is to develop a nonviolent strategy for legally disrupting authoritarian rule. Civil society groups in the U.S., like Indivisible, are charting a path for this. Their strategy has five key elements. The first element is organizing local resistance groups from the bottom up in every state, blue states and red, across race, class, generation, and geography throughout the country. The second element is developing networks to reach people in the pillars of society, government, business, labor, law, education, media, culture, religion, to persuade them to stop yielding to the regime's authoritarian demands. The third element is nonviolent advocacy in support of vulnerable people and institutions targeted by the regime for intimidation, retribution, detention, or extortion. For example, immigrants, universities, media, law firms, public officials, and others. And the fourth element is using nonviolent tactics to reduce the power of the regime and its enablers, strikes, boycotts, and other forms of economic or political non-cooperation, like those that were used in the civil rights movement. And the fifth element is training local resistance groups to avoid violence and to de-escalate any confrontations with antagonists or regime supporters. So today, grassroots organizations like Indivisible, Public Citizen, and 5051 are connecting neighbors and organizing them into thousands of local groups across the country. The groups meet regularly and plan actions like lobbying officials, commenting on social media, criticizing authoritarian policies, displaying resistance signs, and hosting teach-in sessions. These local groups then coordinate with state and national mobilization activities to carry out nationwide demonstrations like the three No Kings protests this year, in which a cumulative total of about 15 million people participated in cities and towns in every state across the country. While these demonstrations may seem at first to be performative and symbolic, their impact over time has been to activate civil society and train people to form networks to implement the resistance strategy of mass protest, victim support, regime defection, peaceful non-cooperation, and de-escalation training. Now, courage is contagious. And it's no accident that the very large turnouts for last month's off-year elections came after the huge national protests of the spring